A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi, Herman and Corin. So we've talked in many episodes. In fact, I'd say one of the defining features of the great journey of inquiry that this podcast provides is understanding how our world works and often gaping in amazement at how things that seem quite ordinary to us humans living in 2026, like the fact that we can order a GPU card from China that arrives on our doorstep in 4 days when, perplexingly, it takes a month for something to come from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. But that's a different grievance and a different story. But the logistics are amazing, and we did some really interesting episodes. In fact, you kind of know that they're amazing. I mean, you assume it's a pretty impressive feat, but they're even more amazing than that. There is pre-processing and AI being used to actually pre-position goods. Fascinating stuff, but we cover that ground in another episode. I'd like to talk about one facet of today's world that I think few of us pause to think about, and that is how we're able to get basically all manner of produce all of the time everywhere. By which I mean, if you walk into a supermarket in the West and also here in Jerusalem, although I would say that our local produce market here is significantly more seasonal than what I was used to growing up in Ireland. We do at least have a very, very, very definitive bend by which we have specific seasons during which fruits are plentiful and relatively affordable, and then they come to an end, and it's always a disappointing, or it's always sad. I love getting into the watermelon and the orange and the nectarine. I look forward to all of them. It's actually one of my favorite things about living here. I'm a big fruit eater, so these little seasonal waves are great. But we do also have a backdrop of a few things and crops that are permanently available. And none of this happens naturally. If you're in a supermarket in Ireland and you can buy bananas 365 days a year, the bananas didn't magically drop out of the sky or were grown next door. There's a whole import mechanism that's necessary for that. Now, what I'm getting to is the sustainability aspect, because this is the kind of thing that gnaws at me, and I wish it didn't sometimes. But when I think about stuff like flying, I've often just wondered, and again, we did an episode here, can flying ever be sustainable, or are we just deluding ourselves into thinking that we can travel at 30,000 feet even with the best and most sustainable fuel available, that I think according to these statistics, only a very small amount of commercial aviation operators are using. Even with all the best things possible, is this just an inherently unsustainable enterprise? And I have to say, I've wondered the same thing about how we have produce around the world, because I think you'd be hard-pressed to make the case that anyone in Ireland or in the UK or in Israel really needs to be able to purchase bananas all of the time. So Herman and Corin, if we were to give up on this, it would be a dramatically changed world. And I think one of the first, maybe the main non-starter is that we couldn't enjoy coffee. Coffee, of course, is grown only in a few very specific parts of the world, but is exported absolutely everywhere. And I think we might have a very hard time pushing any kind of environmental reform if people were told that they'd have to give up their coffee. But what would it look like in terms of reshaping global trade if we were to return en masse somehow, hypothetically, to a purely local, seasonal-based market in terms of the availability of food? We're talking about not just fruits and vegetables, but also crops. What would a supermarket actually look like if we were to envision such a thing in your typical Western country? I'd imagine there'd be a lot less variety, and a lot of things just wouldn't be there because they don't grow anywhere near locally. Sometimes I've wondered about this. Herman and Corin, has anyone suggested or tried the idea at any kind of scale, or even run some calculations or forecasts as to how much emissions would be avoided if we all returned to purely local eating.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's the kind of question that sits in the back of your head while you're doing something mundane, like eating a banana in February. He's asking what the world would actually look like if we abandoned global food supply chains and returned to purely local, seasonal eating. Not as a lifestyle choice for a few farmers market enthusiasts, but as an enforced reality for everyone. What happens to the supermarket? What happens to coffee? What happens to the entire architecture of global trade? And has anyone actually run the numbers on what emissions we'd save?
I love this prompt because it takes something we all vaguely sense, that eating local feels virtuous and pushes it to its logical extreme. Not should you buy the local tomatoes, but what if there were no other tomatoes?
The prompt mentions that coffee would be the immediate non-starter for any serious political movement here, which is probably correct. You could pry bananas from people's cold dead hands before you'd get them to surrender caffeine.
Coffee is the glockenspiel of corporate approachability, but also, somehow, the non-negotiable backbone of civilization itself.
I don't know what that means, and I'm choosing to move past it. So let's start with the emissions question, because that's the empirical hook here. Has anyone actually done the calculation? If we all switch to purely local diets tomorrow, how much carbon would we actually save?
This is where the data gets genuinely surprising, and where most of the popular conversation goes wrong. There's a fantastic analysis from Our World in Data that breaks this down, and the headline finding is that transport accounts for a remarkably small slice of food's total emissions. For most food products, transport represents less than 10% of the total carbon footprint, and in many cases, it's closer to 5 or 6%.
That's lower than I would have guessed. I think most people assume the shipping is the big sin.
It's the most visible sin, which is why we fixate on it. You can picture the container ship, the truck, the airplane. But what you can't picture is the land use change, the fertilizer, the methane from cattle, the nitrous oxide from soil management. Those upstream production impacts absolutely dwarf transportation. For beef, transport is typically less than 1% of total emissions.
Buying local beef versus beef shipped from another continent is basically a rounding error compared to the choice to eat beef in the first place.
And that's the uncomfortable core of this entire conversation. What you eat matters enormously more than where it came from. The Our World in Data team found that shifting to a completely local diet, eliminating all food transport miles, would reduce the average person's food carbon footprint by roughly 5 to 10%, which is not nothing. But it's not transformative in the way people imagine.
That's the global average! For developed countries, where diets are more meat-heavy, the production emissions are so large that the transport share shrinks even further.
There was a comprehensive study in the journal Global Food Security that modeled what would happen if every country returned to consuming only domestically produced food. The global reduction in food system emissions would be about 8%. 8% for completely dismantling the global food trade architecture that took a century to build.
We'd be torching an incomprehensibly complex system for single-digit percentage gains. That's not a great trade.
It gets worse when you look at the knock-on effect. The same study found that those modest emission reductions would be partially offset by the fact that some regions would have to shift to less efficient production methods. If you can't grow wheat in a place that's optimized for wheat, you grow it somewhere less suitable, with more inputs, more irrigation, more fertilizer. You might end up emitting more per calorie even as you eliminate the shipping.
Which is the classic local food paradox. The tomato grown in a heated greenhouse in the UK in January has a larger carbon footprint than the tomato shipped from Spain, where it grew in actual sunlight.
A BBC Future piece dug into exactly this, citing research that British tomatoes grown out of season in heated greenhouses produce about 3 times the emissions of Spanish tomatoes shipped to the UK. The transport is a fraction of the heating cost. So local can actually mean worse depending on the crop and the season.
Which is the kind of fact that makes the local food absolutist head explode. You're telling them the virtuous choice is the one that traveled further, and their entire framework collapses.
Yet the intuition persists, because it's emotionally legible in a way that fertilizer chemistry isn't. You can see the food miles, you can't see the nitrous oxide.
Let's take the prompt's hypothetical seriously, despite the disappointing emissions math. What does the supermarket actually look like in this world?
The first thing to understand is that the modern supermarket is a triumph of logistics that essentially abolished seasonality for anyone with enough money. The result is a kind of permanent global summer in the produce aisle. Strawberries in December, asparagus in October, avocados perpetually.
The produce section, as a monument to human defiance of geography.
So in our purely local scenario, that monument crumbles. And what replaces it depends heavily on where you live. Let's take the UK or Ireland in winter, since the prompt mentions growing up in Ireland. You're looking at root vegetables. Potatoes, carrots, parsnips, turnips, onions, cabbages, kale, leeks, apples and pears from storage. That's the fresh produce section from roughly November through March.
Storage becomes a huge part of the story, right? Because you're not just eating what's in season this week. You're eating what was in season 4 months ago and preserved.
And this is where a purely local food system would have to rebuild entire preservation infrastructures that we've let atrophy. Cold storage, root cellaring, fermentation, drying, canning. These would become central to the food experience in a way they haven't been since the 1950s. Your winter diet wouldn't be fresh strawberries from Spain. It would be last summer's strawberries as jam.
Which is actually how humans ate for most of history. We've only had this permanent fresh produce abundance for about 2 generations, and we've already come to think of it as the natural order.
There's a wonderful phrase from the food historian Rachel Lawdon. She called this the culinary ludism trap, this idea that pre-industrial food systems were somehow more natural or virtuous. She points out that for most of human history, the local seasonal diet was monotonous, precarious, and often nutritionally inadequate. People relied on storage and preservation because the alternative was starvation, not because it was charming.
The Instagrammable root cellar aesthetic is a luxury belief, if there ever was one.
It absolutely is, and it's worth sitting with the nutritional implications. In a purely local UK winter diet, you'd have essentially zero dietary vitamin C from fresh sources for months at a time, unless you were eating a lot of stored cabbage and kale, which do retain some. Scurvy was a genuine seasonal disease in Northern Europe before global trade brought citrus.
The supermarket produce section in winter isn't just smaller. It's a different category of thing entirely. It goes from being a cornucopia to being a pantry.
That's for a temperate developed country with good agricultural land. The picture gets dramatically worse in places that aren't blessed with productive growing conditions. Think about desert countries, northern latitudes, small island nations. The prompt mentions Israel, and Israel actually has a remarkably productive agricultural sector, heavily irrigated, technologically sophisticated. But even here, a purely local diet would mean no rice, no coffee, no chocolate, no bananas, no black pepper. The spice aisle essentially vanishes.
The spice aisle vanishing is a bigger deal than people realize. Global trade in spices is literally what kicked off the age of exploration. The entire shape of modern geopolitics traces back to Europe, wanting pepper and cinnamon that didn't grow anywhere nearby.
It's not just about pleasure and variety. Spices were originally a preservation technology. Pepper and cinnamon and cloves have antimicrobial properties. They made food safer in an era before refrigeration. We forget that global food trade has been a food safety mechanism for centuries.
We're not just talking about a less fun supermarket. We're talking about a less safe food supply in some contexts, though modern refrigeration changes that calculation somewhat. But the broader point stands. The local food vision sounds pastoral and wholesome until you realize it means the end of food security for a significant fraction of the global population. Let's talk about coffee, since the prompt specifically flags it as the political non-starter.
Coffee is the perfect case study in why this is so hard. It's grown commercially in a narrow band around the equator. The top producers are Brazil, Vietnam, Colombia, Indonesia, Ethiopia. If you live in Europe, North America, Australia, most of Asia, the Middle East, you cannot grow coffee locally. There is no local coffee option.
Unless you're willing to invest in a heated greenhouse and accept coffee that tastes like regret and costs about $200 a cup.
Even then, coffee plants take 3 to 4 years to produce their first harvest. They require specific altitude and temperature conditions, and they're finicky. So in a purely local food system, coffee simply disappears for about 95% of the world's current coffee drinkers.
Which would make the COVID toilet paper panic look like a minor logistical hiccup. You're talking about cutting off the world's most popular psychoactive drug, cold turkey, for billions of people.
It's not just the caffeine addiction, though that's real and physically unpleasant to break. Coffee is deeply embedded in social rituals, in work routines, in hospitality traditions across dozens of cultures. The Ethiopian coffee ceremony, the Italian espresso bar, the Swedish fika, the Turkish coffee reading, all of it just...
The prompt's point about this being a political non-starter is, if anything, understated. You'd have riots. You'd have black markets. You'd have people roasting chicory root in their basements and lying to themselves about it.
Which, historically, is exactly what happened during the American Civil War when Union blockades cut off coffee supplies to the South. People roasted chicory, okra seeds, sweet potato, rye. None of it was coffee, but the ritual persisted.
The local food revolution would immediately create a global coffee-smuggling empire that would make the drug cartels look like amateurs. And that's before we even get to chocolate, tea, vanilla, black pepper, cinnamon.
The entire flavor profile of modern cuisine collapses. And this is where I think the local food movement, in its more absolutist forms, fails to grapple with what it's actually proposing. It's not a return to some imagined agrarian paradise. It's a return to a world where food was boring, monotonous, and sometimes dangerous for large portions of the year.
Though I want to push back on that slightly, because I think there's a middle ground that the prompt is gesturing toward that's more nuanced than total autarky. The question isn't just, what if we banned all food imports? But what would a more seasonal, more local-leaning food system look like if we took it seriously?
That's fair. And I think the answer is that it would look different in different places. But there are some common patterns. You'd see a much stronger rhythm to the culinary year. Certain foods would become events rather than constants. The first asparagus of spring, the first strawberries of early summer, the first apples of autumn. These would be exciting in a way they can't be when everything is always available.
There's something lost when you can buy strawberries in December. Not just environmentally, but experientially. The strawberry becomes a background object rather than a marker of June.
The Japanese have a concept around this, shun, which refers to the peak season for a particular food when it's at its absolute best. And there's a cultural reverence for that moment. You eat the food when it's in shun, and then you wait until next year. It creates a culinary calendar that connects you to the actual rhythms of the natural world.
That's a genuine form of richness, not deprivation. Having less variety at any given moment, but more anticipation, more appreciation, more meaning attached to each food's arrival.
I think that's right, and I think that's the version of this that's actually defensible and appealing. Not abolishing global food trade, but rebalancing towards seasonality and away from the expectation that everything should be available always.
What does that supermarket actually look like? Not the absolutist version where nothing crosses a border, but the rebalanced version.
I think you'd see a produce section that's larger in total square footage, but more dynamic in what it contains. In summer, it's overflowing with local tomatoes and corn and stone fruit and berries, much of it from within a few hundred miles. In winter, it contracts. You still have some imports, citrus from Spain, avocados from Israel or Mexico, but they're positioned as supplements, not as the main event.
You'd probably see a lot more preserved products integrated into the regular shopping experience, rather than ghettoized in a canned goods aisle. Frozen local vegetables, dried local fruits, fermented local vegetables. The boundary between fresh and preserved would blur.
Fermentation specifically would see a massive renaissance, and we're already seeing this in the food world. Kimchi, sauerkraut, kombucha, miso, these have all exploded in popularity in the last decade. There's a version of this future where the supermarket has a significant fermentation section, with locally produced preserved vegetables that carry you through the winter.
The hipster pickle aisle is climate adaptation strategy.
I mean, unironically, yes. And the economics are interesting, too. A more seasonal, more local food system would likely mean higher food prices overall, because you're losing the economies of scale that come from sourcing globally from the cheapest producer at any given moment. But you'd also see a shift in where the money goes. More of your food dollar going to farmers within your region rather than to shipping companies and international commodity traders.
Which has its own knock-on effect. Regional economies become more resilient. Agricultural land near cities becomes more valuable, which could slow the sprawl of suburbs into farmland. You might see the return of the market garden belt around cities, which was the norm before refrigerated trucking made it possible to ship produce from California to New York.
The urban agriculture dimension is fascinating here too. There's been a lot of enthusiasm about vertical farming and rooftop greenhouses, and I think in this rebalanced scenario, those technologies find their actual niche. Not replacing all agriculture, but providing specific high-value crops that don't ship well. Herbs, salad greens, soft fruits, things where freshness matters enormously and the transport cost is high relative to the product value.
The basil that goes from harvest to your plate in 3 hours instead of 3 days. You can taste that difference.
You absolutely can. And that's the kind of crop where local production makes both culinary and environmental sense. The emissions from shipping basil by air from Israel to the UK in January are significant per calorie because basil is basically water in flavor. It's not a calorie-dense food. The transport emissions per unit of nutrition are terrible.
Which brings us back to the emissions question with more nuance. The prompt asked if anyone has run the calculations on how much emissions would be avoided. And the answer seems to be about 5-10% for a full localization, but with enormous variation by crop and by region. Some specific supply chains, like air-freighted perishables, are terrible and worth eliminating. Others, like shipped dry goods, are surprisingly efficient.
The key distinction is between air freight and sea freight. Air freight is roughly 50 times more carbon intensive per ton kilometer than ocean shipping. So when people talk about food miles, what they should really be talking about is food air miles. And here's the thing. Air freight accounts for less than 1% of total food ton kilometers globally, but it accounts for something like 11% of food transport emissions.
The problem is highly concentrated. A tiny fraction of food, the stuff that's flown rather than shipped, causes a disproportionate share of the damage.
And what gets flown? Perishable high-value items. Berries, asparagus, green beans, fresh herbs, some tropical fruits. If you wanted to design a policy intervention that maximized emissions reduction while minimizing disruption to food availability, you'd target air freight specifically, not food trade generally.
Ban air freighted produce, keep the container ships, you lose out-of-season berries and you keep coffee and bananas. That's a trade I think most people would accept.
It's one that would actually move the needle. The Our World in Data analysis suggests that eliminating air freighted food would reduce total food system emissions by roughly 1-2% globally, which is still modest, but it's a much better ratio of disruption to benefit than banning all food trade for that 5-10% number.
The smart version of this impulse, the version that actually engages with the data rather than the vibes, is not eat local, but eat like your food wasn't on a plane.
That's a much better heuristic, and it's one that naturally aligns with seasonality because the foods that get flown are typically the ones that are out of season locally. If you're eating with the seasons, you're naturally avoiding most air-freighted produce.
Let's talk about the grain and staple crop question, because that's where the local food vision really collides with reality. The prompt mentions crops, not just fruits and vegetables. What happens to bread in a local food system?
This is where things get difficult. Wheat, rice, maize, these staple grains are the caloric backbone of human civilization, and they're grown in specific regions that have the right combination of climate, soil, and water. The great wheat belts of the world, the North American Plains, the Russian Steppe, the Australian Wheat Belt, these produce grain at scales and efficiencies that can't be replicated everywhere.
If you're in a country that doesn't have a natural wheat belt, you're either eating a different staple or you're growing wheat in suboptimal conditions with higher inputs and lower yields.
That's already happening in some places. There are countries in sub-Saharan Africa that import significant amounts of wheat because it's cheaper to buy it from the global market than to grow it domestically. In a local food system, those countries would face a brutal choice. Either shift their diets to locally viable staples like sorghum and millet and cassava, or accept much higher food prices and lower food security.
Which is a reminder that the local food vision looks very different depending on whether you live in California or Chad. For people in agriculturally blessed regions, it's a lifestyle adjustment. For people in marginal growing environments, it's potentially catastrophic.
There's a deep tension here that the local food movement often papers over. The global food trade system, for all its environmental costs, has been an extraordinary engine of food security. It means that a drought in one region doesn't cause famine, because food can flow from regions with surplus. The localized food system is inherently more vulnerable to local weather shocks.
The Irish potato famine is the canonical example here. A single crop failure in a food system that had become over-reliant on a single local staple, and a million people died. Global trade isn't just about variety and pleasure, it's about resilience.
This is where I think the absolutist local food vision actually becomes morally problematic. It's a proposal to dismantle the resilience mechanisms that prevent famine in exchange for modest emissions reductions, while imposing the heaviest costs on the people who are already most food insecure.
The luxury belief framework applies here with uncomfortable precision. The person advocating for a fully local food system is typically someone who has never experienced genuine food scarcity. They're proposing a system that would be an inconvenience for them and a disaster for the global poor.
I think that's right. And I think it's why the more thoughtful voices in the sustainable food space have moved away from food miles as a primary metric and toward a more holistic view that considers production methods, land use, water consumption, and food security alongside transport emissions.
What's the actual path forward that takes the genuine insight of the local food movement that our food system has become disconnected from ecological reality without falling into the trap of food autarky?
I think it looks like a handful of principles rather than a single rule. First, eat with the seasons when you can. It's almost always better environmentally, it's often better culinarily, and it reconnects you to the actual rhythms of food production. Second, target air freight specifically. If it had to fly, think hard about whether you need it. Third, focus on what you eat, not where it came from. Shifting from beef to chicken reduces your food footprint far more than shifting from imported chicken to local chicken. Fourth, preserve and ferment. Build the infrastructure and the cultural knowledge to eat well through the winter without relying on fresh produce flown from the other hemisphere.
Fifth, I'd add, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. A food system where most people eat mostly seasonal, mostly local, but still have access to coffee and spices and bananas and the occasional out-of-season treat. That's a dramatically better system than what we have now. And it's actually achievable without breaking civilization.
The coffee exception is important because it acknowledges that food is not just fuel. It's culture, it's pleasure, it's ritual. A sustainable food system that nobody wants to live in is not a sustainable food system. It's a punishment.
The puritanical strand in environmentalism has always struggled with this. The idea that if it feels good, it must be sinful. But pleasure is not the enemy of sustainability. The enemy is waste and inefficiency and externalized costs. You can have a food system that's both joyful and ecologically sane.
I think the data supports this. The biggest wins in food system emissions don't come from eliminating the pleasures. They come from changing how we produce the staples. Regenerative agriculture for grains, better manure management for livestock, reduced fertilizer overuse, methane capture from rice paddies. These are the things that move the needle, not whether your garlic came from China or California.
Though I will say, on the garlic point specifically, there's an interesting case study. Most of the garlic sold in the US comes from China. It's shipped, not flown. The transport emissions are negligible. But there are concerns about production practices, about bleaching, about labor conditions. So, local sometimes functions as a proxy for concerns that aren't about carbon at all. It's a shorthand for transparency and trust.
That's a really important point. When people say they want local food, they're often saying they want to know something about how their food was produced. They want a relationship with the producer, or at least the possibility of one. That's not about carbon. That's about alienation from the food system.
The industrial food system is opaque by design. You don't know who grew your garlic, or how, or whether they were paid fairly. The local farmer's market makes that visible. You can ask the farmer about their practices. That visibility feels virtuous, and it's easy to conflate that virtue with environmental benefit.
Sometimes it aligns, and sometimes it doesn't. The small local farm might be using practices that are actually more carbon-intensive per unit of output than the large, efficient operation. But the small farm might also be better for biodiversity, better for soil health, better for the local economy. These are different values, and they don't all point in the same direction.
The prompt's question, what would the supermarket look like, is really a question about which values we're optimizing for. If we're optimizing purely for carbon, the answer is not that different from today, minus the air-freighted perishables and with a lot less red meat. If we're optimizing for local economic resilience, it's a much more radical transformation.
If we're optimizing for the full suite of things we actually care about, food security, pleasure, culture, ecological health, economic fairness, it's a complex negotiation with no single right answer. The supermarket of the future probably has a seasonal core supplemented by responsibly traded imports, a significant preservation and fermentation section, and a much stronger connection between the consumer and the producer.
The supermarket of the future definitely still has coffee.
The coffee stays. That's non-negotiable. The global coffee supply chain is actually a fascinating case of something that's worth preserving. Most coffee is shipped by sea, not flown. The transport emissions per cup are tiny compared to the production emissions, and coffee is a crop that supports millions of smallholder farmers in developing countries. Eliminating coffee imports would be an environmental rounding error and an economic catastrophe for some of the world's poorest people.
Which is the perverse thing about a lot of local food absolutism. It would hurt developing country farmers far more than it would hurt anyone in the rich world. Those Kenyan green beans that get air freighted to British supermarkets, people love to hate on those. But those green beans are a livelihood for thousands of Kenyan farmers. Cutting them off doesn't just change what's available at Tesco. It eliminates an income stream in a country where alternatives are scarce.
There's a really thoughtful analysis from the International Institute for Environment and Development on exactly this point. They found that the air-freighted produce trade from sub-Saharan Africa to Europe supports something like a million livelihoods directly and indirectly. And the carbon footprint, while real, is modest in global terms. The emissions from all of Africa's air-freighted produce exports to Europe are roughly equivalent to the emissions from a single medium-sized coal power plant.
We're moralizing about Kenyan green beans while running dozens of coal plants. The proportionality is completely broken.
That's the frustration I have with the food miles conversation. It captures so much cultural attention relative to its actual importance. People agonize over whether to buy the local apple or the imported apple, and the difference between those two choices is trivial compared to whether they're eating beef or lentils for dinner.
The local apple versus imported apple debate is the recycling of the food world. It feels meaningful, it's visible, it gives you that little hit of virtue. But the actual impact is orders of magnitude smaller than the invisible structural choices.
Just like recycling, I don't want to say it's worthless. It's not. It's a small positive contribution. The problem is when it becomes a substitute for the harder changes. When people feel like they've done their part because they bought the local tomatoes, and therefore they don't need to think about the beef they're eating four times a week.
To answer the prompt's core question directly, yes, people have run the calculations. A fully localized global food system would reduce food emissions by roughly 5 to 10%, with enormous variation by region and with significant costs to food security, dietary diversity, and the livelihoods of farmers in developing countries. The smarter play is to target specific high-emission supply chains, air freight, and red meat production, while preserving the global trade in stable crops and shelf-stable goods that provides resilience and food security.
The supermarket in that rebalanced world looks like a place where seasonality is celebrated rather than suppressed, where preservation and fermentation are mainstream rather than niche, where imports are thoughtful rather than default, and where the connection between eater and producer is shorter and more legible. But it's not a supermarket without coffee, or spices, or bananas. It's not a supermarket that feels like a punishment.
It's a supermarket that feels like a place, connected to an actual region with actual seasons, rather than a portal to a permanent global summer.
That's the version of this that I think is both achievable and desirable. Not the hair shirt version where we all pretend to enjoy eating turnips for 4 months straight, but the version where the first strawberry of June is an event worth waiting for.
The prompt mentions that one of the joys of living in a place with real seasons is the arrival and departure of specific fruits. The watermelon season, the nectarine season, that rhythm is enriching. And I think what the global food system has done is flatten that rhythm into a constant hum. Everything always, nothing special.
There's a phrase from the food writer Tamar Adler. She talks about the pleasure of the season as something distinct from the pleasure of the food itself. It's the pleasure of anticipation, of waiting, of the food being embedded in a particular moment in time. A peach in August is not the same experience as a peach in February, even if the peach itself were identical, which it isn't.
The February peach is a ghost of a peach. It looks like a peach, but it tastes like slightly sweetened cardboard. You're not actually getting year-round access to the same thing. You're getting year-round access to a degraded simulation of the thing.
That's the part of the local food argument that I find persuasive, even if the carbon math doesn't always support it. The quality argument. Food that's grown nearby, in season, and eaten soon after harvest is simply better. The tomato that ripened on the vine and traveled 50 miles is a different food from the tomato that was picked green and gassed and shipped 3,000 miles.
Maybe the right framing isn't environmental virtue at all. Maybe it's culinary discernment. You eat local and seasonal not because you're trying to save the planet, but because you're trying to eat food that actually tastes good.
That's a much easier sell, politically and culturally. Nobody wants to be told they're a bad person for buying imported grapes. But everyone wants to eat a tomato that actually tastes like a tomato. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1950s Bhutan, yak butter was preserved for multi-year storage by being packed into hollowed sheep horns and sealed with pine resin, then buried in high-altitude permafrost. Modern lab analysis of a recovered 50-year-old sample found the butter retained 94% of its original lipid stability, comparable to commercial deep-freeze storage at minus 40 degrees Celsius.
Right. The question that lingers for me is whether the rebalanced food system we've been describing is actually achievable through consumer choice and cultural shift, or whether it requires policy intervention that's politically toxic. Because right now, the people who care about this stuff are a niche. The average shopper wants cheap, convenient, and familiar, and the global food system delivers that brilliantly.
I think it requires both. Consumer demand creates the market signal, but policy shapes the playing field. Things like clearer labeling about production methods and transport mode, carbon pricing that actually reflects the externalities of air freight, investment in regional food processing and distribution infrastructure. These are the boring policy levers that make the virtuous choice easier and cheaper.
None of that requires banning anything. It just requires making the true costs visible and letting people decide. If air-freighted asparagus actually costs what it costs, including its climate damage, people would buy less of it. Not zero, but less. And the system would rebalance organically.
The carbon price is the most elegant and the most politically impossible tool in the entire sustainability toolkit. Everyone who studies this seriously comes to the same conclusion. Price carbon. And everyone who practices politics comes to the same conclusion. You can't.
Though food is maybe the domain where it's most feasible, because the alternatives are appealing. Paying a bit more for seasonal produce that tastes better is not a hard sell. Paying more for the same industrial tomato but with a carbon surcharge, that's a harder sell.
That's why I think the cultural shift towards seasonality and quality is actually the more important lever. If people come to value the seasonal rhythm for its own sake, for the pleasure it provides, then the policy follows naturally. You don't need to ban out-of-season produce if nobody wants to buy it anyway.
The prompt opened with a reflection on how amazing the logistics are, and I think that's worth sitting with as we close. The global food system is one of the great achievements of human civilization. It feeds 8 billion people, it provides unprecedented variety, it buffers against local crop failures, and it does all this at a cost that's fallen steadily for decades. The question isn't whether to dismantle it. The question is how to keep what's valuable while shedding what's destructive.
I think the answer is more nuanced and more achievable than either the defenders of the status quo or the local food absolutists want to admit. You can have a food system that's mostly seasonal, mostly regional, still globally connected for the things that matter, and dramatically lower in emissions without anyone having to give up coffee. That's not a fantasy. That's a design challenge.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this show running.
This has been My Weird Props. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Eat the peach in August. Skip it in February. You'll survive.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show. My weird prompts, where odd thoughts go, from sloth's slow takes to facts on cue. We chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.